This is Supernatural, Chapter 1, The Plant That Enables Men to See the Dead. I lay on a couch in the darkened drawing room of a 200-year-old townhouse in the English city of Bath. The streets outside were deserted and offered few clues to remind me of the familiar world. It was reassuring to find that I could still read the luminous dial of my wristwatch if I held it in front of my eyes. 10 minutes passed, then 20, then 35. I began to feel bored, restless, even a little blasé. After 45 minutes, I closed my eyes and directed my thoughts inwards towards contemplation, still noticing nothing unusual. But at the end of the first hour of my vigil, when I tried to stand up and walk around, I was amazed to discover that my legs wouldn't work. Out of nowhere, an enervating feebleness had ambushed my limbs. The slightest physical effort set off uncontrollable tremors and stumbling, and I'd completely lost my sense of balance. A wave of dizziness and nausea washed over me, and I fell back exhausted on the couch, drenched in a cold sweat. I remembered with a shudder of finality that I couldn't change my mind, because there was no antidote. Once it was underway, the process I was going through could not be stopped and would simply have to be endured. My hearing was the next faculty affected. At intervals, there would be a tremendous ringing and buzzing in my ears, blotting out all other sounds. My eyesight also rapidly deteriorated, soon becoming so obstructed at the edges with strange black lines like fence posts or gratings that I could no longer see my watch, and had to abandon all control of time. For what felt like a very long while, the poison remorselessly tightened its grip, and I fell prey to indescribable sensations of physical and psychic unease. There was a great deal of pain, weakness, and discomfort. It was as if my body were being slowly and systematically smashed and dismembered, and I began to fear that I might never be able to put it back together again. In a moment of stillness, when my eyes were closed, a vision popped up, a vivid, moving tapestry of intertwining branches and leaves, elaborate arabesques and Celtic knotwork. I blinked my eyes open. Instantly, the writhing patterns vanished and the darkened drawing room returned. But as soon as I closed my eyes, the patterns came back. More unmeasured time passed while the patterns continued to expand and multiply. Then another great gust of dizziness hit me, and I winced at the terrifying new sensation it brought of balancing on a swaying tightrope over a bottomless abyss. I found that if I lay on my back, looked straight up at the ceiling, and stayed absolutely still, I could minimize these uncomfortable effects. But all it took was the slightest movement of my head to left or right to bring on another spectacular surge of vertigo. When at last I closed my eyes again, the sinuous intertwined patterns reappeared with renewed intensity, and then were abruptly overwritten by a profile view of a heavily built, blonde young man with his eyes turned towards me in a glare of reproach. He appeared right at my side, startlingly close. His skin was pallid and his brow blotched with patches of green mold. In the Central African countries of Gabon, Cameroon, and Zaire, certain age-old ancestor cults still flourish in the 21st century. Their members share a common belief based, they say, on direct experience, in the existence of a supernatural realm where the spirits of the dead may be contacted. Like some hypothetical dimension of quantum physics, this other world interpenetrates our own, and yet cannot ordinarily be seen or verified by empirical tests. It is therefore a matter of great interest, with highly suggestive research implications, that tribal shamans claim to have mastered a means, through the consumption of a poisonous shrub known locally as iboka or iboga, by which humans may reach the other world and return alive. How they mastered this skill is told in the origin myth of the indigenous secret society known as the Bwiti. Zameye Mbege, the last of the creator gods, gave us Eboka. One day, he saw the pygmy Bitamu high in an atanga tree, gathering its fruit. He made him fall. He died, and Zame brought his spirit to him. Zame cut off the little fingers and little toes of the cadaver of the pygmy and planted them in various parts of the forest. They grew into the iboka bush. The pygmy's wife was named Atanga. When she heard of the death of her husband, she went in search of his body. Eventually, after many adventures, she came to a cave in the heart of the forest, in which she saw a pile of human bones. As she entered the cave, she heard a voice, as of the voice of her husband, asking who she was, where she came from, and whom she wished to speak with. The voice told her to look to the left at the mouth of the cave. There was the iboka plant. The voice told her to eat its roots. She ate and felt very tired. Then she was told to turn around in the cave. The bones were gone, and in their place stood her husband and other dead relatives. They talked to her and gave her a new name, Disumba, and told her that she had found the plant that would enable men to see the dead. This was the first baptism into Bwiti, and that was how men got the power to know the dead and have their counsel. Today, several million people distributed across Gabon, Cameroon, and Zaire have no difficulty resisting well-financed efforts at conversion aimed at them by Christian and Islamic missionaries. Their allegiance instead is to the Bwiti, into which they've been initiated by consuming huge amounts of iboka root bark shavings and experiencing a journey into supernatural realms. Iboka, also known as iboga, is classified scientifically as Tabernanthe iboga and is a member of the Apocyneae dogbane family. Its root bark turns out to be very special, as the myth of the pygmy asserts, and contains more than a dozen unusual chemicals belonging to a class known as the indole alkaloids. One of them, ibogaine, is the potent hallucinogen responsible for the convincing and life-changing visions experienced by Bwiti initiates, notably encounters with supernatural beings and encounters with the spirits of the dead. Many report meeting their deceased fathers or grandfathers, who act as guides for them in the spirit world. However, the bark must be eaten in toxic quantities if the visionary state is to be attained. And initiates confront an ever-present risk of fatal overdose as they seek out their ancestors. Iboga root bark and ibogaine hydrochloride, the pure extract of the psychoactive alkaloid, are both illegal drugs in the United States, and they're classed under Schedule 1 alongside other major hallucinogens such as LSD and addictive narcotics and stimulants like heroin and crack cocaine. By contrast, in Britain and several other European countries where there's growing scientific recognition of a number of startling therapeutic effects claimed for ibogaine, the drug has not been banned. It may be purchased legally and openly from specialized botanical suppliers and consumed freely in any private place. Even without the barbaric threat of a jail sentence, ibogaine is a very serious business, so I hadn't gone lightly into the decisions that had led me to this couch, this night, and this state of helpless prostration to whatever was coming next. My primary motive, unabashedly, was research. I had deliberately submitted myself to this ordeal as part of a wider, long-term investigation into a mysterious before and after moment that took place in human prehistory, perhaps as recently as 40,000 years ago. Before it, other than a very few widely scattered and isolated examples, there is nothing in the archaeological record left by our ancestors that we would instantly recognize as modern human behavior. After it, the signs that creatures exactly like us have arrived are everywhere. Most notably, in the first definite evidence for beliefs in supernatural realms and beings. Evidence, in other words, for the birth of religion. The clearest possible illustration of this is in Southwest Europe, where sophisticated religious art, the oldest so far discovered in the world, appears suddenly, with no apparent antecedents, between 40,000 and 30,000 years ago, and then endures until approximately 12,000 years ago. This is the art of the great painted caves, such as Chauvet, Lascaux, Pechmeul, and Altamira, surely amongst the most beautiful and enigmatic of all human creations. The cave paintings are rightly famous for their realistic images of Ice Age mammals. Much less well known is the fact that numerous supernatural and chimerical beings, often half human, half animal, are also depicted. An ingenious explanation for the bizarre appearance of these beings, as well as for other intriguing features of the caves, which we'll explore in later chapters, has been put forward by a prestigious international group of anthropologists and archaeologists. The essence of their argument is that the cave art expresses mankind's first and oldest notions of the supernatural, of the soul, and of realms of existence beyond death, notions that took shape in altered states of consciousness, most likely brought on by the consumption of psychoactive plants. Although not to the liking of some scholars, this has been the most widely accepted theory of cave art since the mid-1990s. It is therefore an embarrassment that none of the experts currently advocating it have ever actually consumed any psychoactive plants themselves. Nor do they have any first-hand idea of what an altered state of consciousness is, or any desire to experience one. To give fair consideration to their arguments and to the views of their critics, I felt I needed to be able to judge on the basis of personal experience whether plant-induced visions could be made of strong enough stuff to have convinced early humans of the existence of supernatural realms and of the survival after death of some essence of deceased ancestors. This, in a nutshell, was why I'd taken Ibogaine, for sound, solid, common-sense research reasons. But I have to acknowledge that there was another, much more personal motive as well. It had to do with my own father's painful death from bone cancer the previous autumn, and my inexcusable failure to be at his bedside during the last days of his life. Part of the appeal of this slightly risky experiment with Ibogaine was undoubtedly its promise of encounters with the ancestors, and however tenuous, the possibility of closure and quietus that it seemed to offer. I've probably given the impression up till now that I was alone during my vigil in Bath, but this wasn't the case. The psychoactive dose of Ibogaine that I consumed was administered by an experienced and reputable healer who remained on hand the whole night. My wife Santha was also in the room, and we had a medical doctor present as well. At first I'd been acutely aware of all three, but as the malaise and paralysis deepened, they faded into insignificance, and I seemed to see them, if at all, through panels of thick glass. The same odd disconnection applied to the bowl I'd been given to vomit in. I was able to hold on to it and retch over it, but I was in one place and it was in another. As the night wore on, I could feel my couch undergoing an insidious process of transformation, until eventually it had become a stone sarcophagus within which I was laid out. I experienced a strong sense of constriction and immobility, as though a great weight were pressing down on my chest, and wondered, is this death? At the same instant, the room became very full of people. Not the healer, my wife and the doctor, who might as well have been locked away in a soundproof capsule, but a large and somehow threatening crowd of uninvited guests. They did not vanish when I opened my eyes, as my earlier visions had done, but stayed firmly in view, for the most part anonymous and shadowy, shoulders hunched, heads down. A few showed their faces, but like the young blonde man I'd seen earlier with his mildewed skin, they had the look of the grave. I grew conscious that someone was watching me from far back in the jostling crowd. Lean and middle-aged, with a solemn manner, he was dark-skinned and his features were unmistakably African. His eyes were huge and black as obsidian. He was not old and grey, as was usually the case in the visions of the Bwiti, but the thought came to me that this might be the legendary spirit of Iboga, here to abduct my soul. Iboga is intimately associated with death. The plant is frequently anthropomorphized as a supernatural being, a generic ancestor, who can so highly value or despise an individual that it can carry him away to the land of the dead. I fell into a dream state for what seemed like a very long time. And as with most dreams, I now found it hard to remember the details. All I can confirm is my absolute certain conviction that something happened, something of lasting importance to me. Did I hallucinate an encounter with my father? I don't remember clearly enough to be absolutely sure, but I get flashbacks of that night in which I see him amongst the crowd of phantoms gathered round me. Sometimes the flashbacks are so poignant and intense that I can almost believe he must really have been out there, walking by with dignity and pain, as he did when he was fighting his cancer. As well as these tantalizing recollections of my father, I've managed to dredge up a few other broken images from those hours of fevered dreams, which add to my sense that something momentous occurred. At one point, I felt very strongly that I had awakened. I opened my eyes, expecting to see the familiar outlines of the darkened drawing room. Instead, I found myself in a very strange place that I'd never seen before, with billowing draperies hanging from the walls, trees growing within, and a ceiling transparent to the stars. It seemed like some exotic temple, part sanctuary, part palace, part desert tent. To one side, absorbed in the motions of a dance, I could see a giant figure dressed in flowing white robes with black vertical markings. Was I dreaming or awake? Was what I was seeing real in some way, as it very convincingly seemed to be? Or was it all just a grand illusion? And did the spirit of my father still survive in some other dimension or reality? These were weighty questions, not easily settled. But for now at least, my interest was narrower. Plants like Tabernanthia boga were available to our ancestors and would have had the same effects on them as they do on us. I remembered the overwhelmingly eerie sense I had experienced for much of the night of crowds of the dead gathered round me, crowds of ghosts, crowds of my forebears. Of course, it was reasonable and potentially productive to ask whether it was not precisely experiences of this general sort that gave rise in remote antiquity to mankind's first notions of the spirit world. Since scholarship as yet has no complete or satisfactory explanation for the origins of religion, this is an area that remains ripe for investigation. Towards morning, with light beginning to filter through gaps in the curtains, I wasn't surprised to go through a mild out-of-body experience. These are common amongst Bhuti initiates under the influence of Iboga, and I wasn't completely new to the phenomenon myself. The last time it had happened to me was when I was 16 years old and was nearly killed by a massive electric shock. Now, as then, my consciousness seemed to float near the ceiling of the room for a few moments, looking down on my own body. Now, as then, I felt detachment and curiosity, certainly not fear, and reveled in the lightness of being and freedom of flight I seemed to be able to enjoy in the disembodied state. Now, as then, the hallucination, or whatever it was, rapidly faded, and the out-of-body view was quickly lost. I was left with a philosophical reflection in the form of a cartoon image of a large sausage tightly knotted at one end. This is what we are, the image seemed to be saying. The message was obvious, almost a cliché, that it is pointless to dwell on the physical and material aspects of life, because ultimately our bodies are just overstuffed sausage skins. For more than 12 hours after the visions ended, I remained violently ill and was unable to walk. It was not until the second night that my strength began to return, the muscle tremors stopped, and I recovered my sense of balance. By the following morning, I felt completely better and ravenously hungry, and went through a long, active day without any sense of fatigue. Iboga is a shamanic drug. In the Bhuti scheme of things, it brings healing in this world by reconnecting us to the world of spirits. My visions, I knew, had been relatively subdued and unspectacular by comparison with those of the Bhuti initiates. But I too, in my own limited way, had experienced contact with some sort of other world through consumption of their sacred plant. Was it really a supernatural realm that the Ibogaine took me into, or just a crazy hallucination? As I've emphasized, this was not something I was yet in a position to judge, nor was it easy to disentangle cause from effect. But what was miraculous, nonetheless, was the dramatic turnaround in my mood that I benefited from after my Ibogaine session. For months beforehand, I'd been intensely depressed and irritable, filled with morbid thoughts and gloomy anxiety. My guilt at what I perceived as my dismal failure of my father and my grief at his loss had been compounded by feelings of worthlessness and anguish so deep that I frequently saw no point in taking any further initiatives in life. It was better by far, I had persuaded myself, to withdraw from the world, abandon research, and avoid all new intellectual challenges, which anyway I would certainly fail. I hadn't expected Ibogaine to make a difference, but it did. From the moment I woke up with my strength recovered, I knew that it had flipped some sort of switch in me, because I was no longer able to see anything in the world in the same negative and nihilistic way as I'd done before. From time to time, a morbid thought would still stray across my mind and try to drag my mood down. Previously, I would have dwelt on it obsessively until it made me miserable. Now I found it easy to dismiss it and move on. I didn't feel so bad about my dad either. I'd not been at his bedside, and I couldn't change that, but somehow now I no longer ached so much. Whether this healing was achieved through contact with the spirit world, or whether it was just a beneficial side effect of shaking up my brain chemistry, I felt grateful to Ibogaine. Regardless of the explanation or the mechanism, it had put me through something I would never forget, something very much like a religious experience. It had swept away the cobwebs of ingrained bad habits and moods, and it had most persuasively demonstrated the worth of a hitherto neglected line of research into the spiritual life of the ancients.